medalist. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's an incredible gentleman on a mission right now to make sure that his name is a little better known. Spencer Haywood joins me now. Spencer, we chatted a couple weeks ago for the TV show I'm on the Jam. Thank you so much for joining us here today. I can't wait to chat.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Spencer, I hear you made a Bozo the Clown reference to producer Pete.
Yeah, well, Pete, I was telling him when I first came up from Mississippi, I was on my way to Detroit, but I stopped over in Chicago for high school. And I was going to go to Crane Tech High School there. And I used to sit and watch Bozo the Clown every day. Mr. Ned! Mr. Ned!
See, even if you were just here for a short time, you're a true Chicagoan when you get to make that reference.
I'm a true Chicago, yes.
There you go. Spencer, I'm in love with your story of your entire journey through your life. I've kind of teased it a couple times, but I just want to make sure I get these facts right. You were born in the South, and at the age of 4 years old with your mother, you began picking cotton for how much a day?
Well, I wasn't making, but the grown-ups were making $2 a day. When I started picking, I was just getting what my mother would give me, like a quarter or whatever. But we picked from sun up to sundown. And if you didn't do that, then you would lose your state of where you would be living, how you would eat. So it was to survive, because we was indentured slavery had taken place. You couldn't leave the farm. You couldn't do any of those things unless you finished picking that cotton and planting the cotton, chopping the cotton, and just actually relegated to the farm. So it was our lifestyle at that time.
How did you get out?
This is not that long ago.
Yeah,
that
was, right? 1950.
Well, what happened was, 64, 65. What happened was the farmers saw me as this project. And the high school basketball coach saw me as a project for basketball. But the farmer was looking at me as if I would be this kid that could, because I worked real hard, that I would be the good guy to stay on the farm. But we have to get away. The farmer said that we would have to get away to keep him on the farm. And in the past, what they would do is they would put you in jail for a while. And then you come out of jail and you relegate it to the farm because you couldn't go back to school or anything. And school was basically shut down for farming anyway. Mm-hmm. And so what happened? They put me in jail. And my mother said, I can't go with that. I can't stand this anymore. And so you're going to have to go up north to stay with your brothers and sisters in Chicago. So that's how I ended up in Chicago with those guys. But they were just drinking and, you know, just having a good time. And school, trying to get registered at Crane Tech, and it was just chaos. And my brother came over from Detroit, and he picked me up and brought me over to Detroit, and that's how I got started over there. But in the cotton field, it was hard, hard work down in Silver City, Mississippi, because, you know, and I wanted to work. I wanted to be the best field hand. I wanted to be the best cotton picker that state and that county had ever experienced, because I had big old hands as a kid. And that's what, you know, people had told me, you know, with those big hands, you're going to be the best cotton picker we've ever had here. Man, we got a thoroughbred here. And I was like, bought in. I was like, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I worked 12 hours a day trying to get to be that best.
It's incredible that that's
from two rows.
Yeah, it's just incredible that this story. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was picking from two rows of cotton, you know, one row on one side, one row on the other. So I was picking from both sides. I got hand and eye coordination. I was dragging a sack that weighed 100 pounds. I was built like a man as a boy. And so what God had in mind for me, it wasn't my idea, but, you know, it was God's idea that, you know, you're going to be trained to be this great basketball player. But I didn't know it until, later on in life, until I got to the Olympics. And then I was like, Oh, so that's what the cotton field was all about.
That was what the plan was. Okay, so let's get through this because I just want to set up the scene. So you go to Detroit, you start playing basketball in high school, eventually in college, and then I want to get to the Supreme Court ruling. So
yes, okay.
So you get out of high school, and you start playing semi-pro? How does that work that you end up being the poster boy, poster man, for this Supreme Court ruling?
Well, what happened was I graduated high school. I went away to Tennessee, the University of Tennessee. The University of Tennessee in Kentucky was scrambling over who was going to permanently sign me and make me their player. And then I left those schools and I left Tennessee, University of Tennessee, and I went to Trinidad State Junior College at Trinidad, Colorado. And that's when the Olympic team, which was in 1968, they had a boycott from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was Lew Alcindor at the time, Elvin Hayes, Wesley Unseld. And so they invited a junior college team. Even though I was a freshman, I was not allowed to play, but they made an exception that particular Olympics because of the boycotts and so on. Mm-hmm. So they invited me down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where we were playing against Pete Maravich, Calvin Murphy, Rick Mount from in your area there, from Purdue. Mm-hmm. All of those great players, Tom Bullwinkle, who played with the Bulls for years, and I outshined them all. And the coach Hank Iver said, "Hey, this is our guy." And they picked me first to start in the 68 Olympic game. And I'm like, "Hey, man, I'm 19 years old. What are you doing?"
So you go down to Mexico City, which you've told me this incredible story that you got to chat with Jesse Owens in the 1968 Olympics.
Yes, we did. Well, Jesse was addressing the Olympic team because uh-huh. there was this ruckus about, you know, who's going to make a stand, who is not going to make a stand. And so George Foreman and I were the two young guys on the Olympic team itself. And he was there for boxing. I was there for basketball. But the leaders on that team was Tommy Smith, John Carlos in particular, and Lee Evans, Bob Beamon, Dina Devaroni, the great swimmer, and Dick Fosbury, who made the high jump and jumped over the bar backwards. And so we were all sitting in this big room. In the room, the door opened, creaks open like it was creaky or something. But it was Jesse. He was moving as an older person, you know. And he walked in, and we sat down and listened to Jesse. And he's talking about what's going to happen after we leave the Olympics if we do the proper things and so on, so on. And so we were like, "Oh, man, this old guy, what do you know?" And Jesse turned to John Carlos, and he looked over at me. And I was like, I'm just sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, "What would it take? What would you have done if you had to run before Hitler?"
Yeah,
and so Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Lee Evans and all of them looked over and they looked at each other. They said, "We're gonna lace them up now. We got to go."
Yeah, if Jesse Owens says that, I could spend this whole interview talking about the 19.
Jesse dropped the H man on us.
Oh yeah. If he drops the Hitler word, I guess that's you better get out there and play. Tell you what, Spencer,
exactly.
I'm going to put you on hold here for a second. I'm going to take the commercial break now.
Okay.
When we come back, I want to talk about the Supreme Court case and everything that means here today here on WGN. Spencer Haywood, we've been chatting with him about his journey from southern Mississippi all the way up to Detroit and then to Mexico City for the 1968 Olympics. Spencer, each one of these topics we could spend a half hour on, but I don't want to miss the most important part of our story here today. And there's a book about it out now, The Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles, Basketball, and the Making of an American Iconoclast, which you can order here today. But Spencer, you sign with the Seattle Supersonics. But you're still not allowed to play for them, correct?
Yeah. Well, see, I had went back to the University of Detroit in my sophomore year, and after my sophomore year, I went to the ABA, And the ABA, I was Rookie of the Year, leading scorer, leading rebounder, and MVP of the league. And then the war was on because I jumped from the ABA to the NBA, and the NBA said, we have a four-year rule that states that you must wait for 4 years after your high school class had graduated before you could enter into the NBA. And I was dusting and wanted to play right at this point in time. And I still had my mother in the cotton fields of Mississippi picking cotton. Her back was out. So I needed to play basketball and make money so I can bring my family up out of poverty. And so when I signed my contract and got ready to walk out on the floor, the NBA had an injunction against me, said that, stating that this player is an illegal player.
Like the announcer, the announcer would say that, the public address announcer.
He said, public address announcer said, ladies and gentlemen, we have an illegal player on the floor, number 24, and this injunction for the next 10 games, we have an injunction against him, and he cannot play in the NBA. And so I waited my 10 games in pain and agony and just training. And then I filed suit for the next 10 games for the rights to play. And they would also state that even though he has the rights to play under this ruling, but he still is an illegal player and this game is being played under protest. So the crowd would throw things on and stuff.
Wow.
I get to another game. But here's what happened. I get to Chicago, and I'm playing against the Bulls when I got my next injunction. And I'm playing, and Chet Walker in the warm-ups says that he hurt his ankle. And the Bulls sued me for $600,000.
For playing?
No, for being on the court.
Are you kidding? Just for standing on the hardwood?
Look it up.
At Chicago Stadium, $600,000?
Yes.
Okay, so eventually this case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm sure it takes time.
All the way to the Supreme Court.
It goes to the Supreme Court.
It took time, lower court, state court, all the way to the district and then to the Supreme Court. So when we got to the Supreme Court, the case was in front of Thurgood Marshall, so he had argued such many, many cases of civil rights. So this was a slash civil rights and a right to play. And so he looked it up under the Sherman Antitrust Act. And he and all of the justices said that you have the right to play because if you can send them, you have the right as the same as a hockey player, a baseball player, or a tennis player. A basketball player have that same right. So they granted me the rights to play under the Sherman Antitrust Act. And that opened up the doors for all of the players that from 1971 until you see today, is you see all of these players under the Spencer Hayward rule, which has made that ruling itself, and I had a lot to do with it, that ruling itself has made and player revenue over $31 billion in contracts.
Billion with a B.
And they still have a billion. And they still have no idea who I am. So the book was written with the idea that this ruling is not early entry. That's what the league is called, early entry, hardship, one and done. It is the Spencer Hayward rule, and it's the only ruling that has been handed down by the Supreme Court. So we're looking to make that change. Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts over at the Players Association and Adam at the NBA Commissioner's Office. We want to make the change, and everybody's trying to make the change, and the players are now working to help make the change, just a change of the name, because they put it under Larry Bird name.
Yeah.
It's not Larry Bird rule. Larry Bird came in under my rule.
Well, why does that matter? I mean, why does it matter to you to have that name be named after you? I mean, besides the obvious that you're the one that went through it, is it a pride thing? I mean, what's your motivating factor? Or is it just so that you're remembered and the many other folks that couldn't do it are remembered too?
Well, I know, because what has happened is I go around the players and so, and they just look like I'm some kind of bum that just, you know, dragged up from the corner. Like, who is this guy? Why is he around the locker room? Get this riffraff out of here. And I'm like, wait a minute here, dude. I'm a Hall of Famer, but beside that, I am the reason you and your family are here. For an example, a guy like LeBron James, he has 4 years to play extra. A number of your players, like, in fact, I was looking it up, I think you only have one player that is not under my rule.
Wow.
On the Chicago Bulls. And so why not know who it is? You have to know the history in order to progress into the future.
Amen. So wait, why is this rule?
That's what it's all about.
Why is this rule so hard to change the name of? Maybe it isn't as hard as I'm making it sound. I mean, you've had conversations with owners. Have you talked to Jerry Reinsdorf? Like, what? How does this get done?
I got to talk to Jerry. He gave me his number too, and he told me, "Look, make sure you call me." And he just reminded me. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Dr. Elvis, my homeboy. Thank you very much.
Well, because not only have you made players money, you've made owners billions of dollars.
Yes, because when we won the case, the teams were averaging $300 million, and now they're, of course, $3 billion. And we only had expansion because we didn't have a pool in which to pool from for players. And when I broke the ruling, then you had a ruling. I mean, you had a rules. The game expanded from 14 teams to 30 teams today, and what we all see. So it's in everybody's interest to do the right thing. So I'm sure it's going to happen. It took this to make it happen. And the late Commissioner David Stern was also writing the foreword in the book, and he passed before he was able to finish it.
Wow.
And it's just the time is right. And we talk about Black Lives Matter. We talk about Black History Matter. What about world history? And I must say that what I look at when I look on the floor in the NBA today, I see players from all over the world, and they are great. So sometimes, you know, the question come up, who is the GOAT and what's going on? So since I'm on Chicago here, I better stick with Michael Jordan.
Well, you golf with him too, yeah. All right.
Spencer, I golf with
him. Yeah, the Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles Basketball in the Making of an American Iconoclast. You can buy it. Let's get this rule changed in the NBA. Shouldn't be too hard. Let's do it, the Spencer Haywood Rule. I have one more question for you, and you can pass, Spencer, because I did not prep you for this.
Okay.
If you don't feel comfortable.
Okay.
Big NBA news last week. Or a lot of it off the court, I guess they are on it, was the national anthem. The Dallas Mavericks weren't playing it for a bit. The NBA says they have to play it. You're a man who grew up in poverty in southern Mississippi, but you also represented the United States and won a gold medal. Do you have any take or opinion on whether we should have a national anthem before every NBA basketball game?
I love the national anthem. You know, when I stood on that floor, they were putting that gold medal on my neck, the one thing that separated me from slavery and the joys of America was that national anthem being played, and they placed that gold medal on my neck, and I cried like a baby. I was like, wow. And so all of my years in high school, even in high school, college, and the pros, I sang this song, and throughout my career. And it's just like it was a hype song to me. It was like an American song. And we have to, in these times, really become really American, because you go to other countries and you listen to them, how they stand up for their national anthem. It is like something really mm-hmm. to behold. And so we have to really, I love Mark Cuban, but players, come on.
All right, Spencer Haywood, thank you for thanks for offering that. I appreciate it. Again, the book, Spencer Haywood Rule, Battles, Basketball, and the Making of an American Iconoclast. Spencer, take care. We'll talk again soon, right?
Thank you so much. Bye.